Okay, good morning, everybody. This is Bio 231. It's August 29th, and we're starting this week the first round of practicum. The first class has had a practicum already, and they're done, and then we move to bones. What happened to my microphone? Still there? Okay, fantastic. Maybe I'll turn it up just a little bit. Okay, how's that? Oh, that's better. And then we move on to bones. So let's see. So the first practicum is this week. That means, next week. That means that's your first lecture test. And don't forget, Monday is a holiday. So some of you that were in lab, I told you what quiz you're going to have next week. Guess what? Those of you that had lab this morning at 7:30, you will not get a quiz next week because there won't be anybody here to give you a quiz. So it's going to be in 2 weeks because Monday is a holiday, right? Labor Day holiday. All right, so the Monday class gets gypped out of a lab. Here, how's that? Even better still. Okay, so a week from Wednesday will be your first lecture test. That's going to include chapters 1, chapter 2, 4, and 5. So it's going to be introductory material like body cavities, etc., then the cell with mitosis, then tissues, and then what we're going to cover today, which is the integumentary system. High in the back. Oh, we got to go back and talk about membranes a little bit? Nervous tissue. Okay, let's go back and talk about some of these things. Where's that at? I think we're pretty close to being done, but maybe not exactly. Yeah. Okay, so that is 4. Oh yeah, tissues. All right, so, well, let's just review a little bit what's in that chapter. You've got tissues. What the heck is a tissue? It's a group of cells. These cells all will have basically the same kind of shape, same kind of function because they have the same shape. They're going to have the same kinds of organelles inside the cell, and even the material outside the cell is going to be similar. So a tissue is just a group of cells all performing the same kind of function. All right, what's the building block of a tissue? So, yeah. And if we put a bunch of different tissues together, what do we get? An organ. Yeah, so make sure you can run up and down that hierarchical level of organization. So, we're moving on to muscles. You got a couple of really good pictures of muscles in your book, and then a couple of really lousy pictures. But here's a good picture. And what stands out in this, to me, are all of these stripes right here. Okay. We need a little telepathy or something so you can see what I'm seeing. Tell you what, let me move this over to here. All right. Okay, so what stands out in this picture are all of these striations, right? And these are due to an organelle that lines up. There's a number of organelles called myofibrils, and those are the contractile elements. These are the elements or the organelles that actually contract. And the proteins have a repeated pattern over and over and over and over again. When we get to muscles, we'll learn something about that pattern. And it's very obvious underneath a light microscope. As a matter of fact, this is one muscle cell right here, and you can see striations. And here's another muscle cell down below it. These are long, linear cells. They're not branched. So sometimes we call those fibers. So a muscle fiber and a muscle cell are exactly the same thing. The striations even line up between different muscle fibers. So it's not very confusing to look at. If I see a dark line here, there's a dark line above it. There's a dark line above it. One interesting thing about skeletal muscle is that they're very long and they have many nuclei. And that's because at one point in time they were maybe 100 different individual cells that fused together to form this big long fiber. And a characteristic of skeletal muscle is that it is under voluntary control. You control when this muscle contracts, to what degree it contracts. And since we call it skeletal muscle, what is it connected to? Your skeleton or bones. So these are the kinds of cells that move your bones around for you. And that's really the only thing that you have conscious control of in your body. Everything else controls itself, like cardiac muscle, for instance. And I remember, we talked about cardiac muscle because what did I do? I played a nasty trick on you. I said, put all your books away. We're going to have a pop quiz instead, right? So you can't really control your heart rate, but you can influence how it beats, or other people can influence like I just did for you. This right here is cardiac muscle. It has some similarities with skeletal muscle. Namely, you see striations, right? You see that repeated pattern. So the internal structure and the internal machinery for shortening this fiber, actually this muscle cell, are pretty much the same, almost exactly the same as in skeletal muscle. But it's not under voluntary control. It's under involuntary control. The other difference that I notice is that these cells are very short. Between these dark lines right here, these really dark lines, which are called intercalated discs, that's the extent of this cell. It's very short, but again, different from skeletal muscle, it can be branched, and I see a branch right here, right? And I can see a branch right over here. And this has to, a very important property in how the heart contracts. It has to contract as a unit, but also from a superficial region of the wall of the heart all the way down to a deep region of the wall of the heart. All these fibers have to contract together. So electrical information can work its way like a ladder because these cells are branched from a superficial region to a deep region within the heart. So the heart contracts as a unit. You don't want one part of the heart to contract and then another, or one layer and then another layer. It should contract as a unit so that it can pump blood. And since these cells are short, although they're branched, but because they're short, they only have one nucleus, which is a distinction compared to the skeletal muscle. Okay. All right, the last kind of muscle is smooth muscle. And smooth muscle, one of the reasons why they call it smooth is because it lacks these striations. So the machinery inside the cell is arranged a whole lot different compared to skeletal and cardiac muscle. But it does have a characteristic with cardiac muscle in that it is involuntary. So smooth muscle that I see right here is in the walls of hollow organs, like of your digestive tract, respiratory tract, reproductive tract has smooth muscle, and it is involuntary. You can't control when it's going to contract or not. So maybe there are some times you wish they would, or you would be able to control it, but you just can't. Right, even under less influence compared to cardiac muscle. These smooth muscle cells are like a football that you stretch from end to end. They have very pointed ends. They're very short. They're not really called fibers, and they're not branched either. Okay, but they're all placed together. Kind of reminds you of an epithelium, but it's not. Okay, and the job of these right here are to shorten once again. So these are just for contraction. And it's not going to pull on a skeleton or a bone, so your bones don't move when this muscle contracts, but these organs are going to change shape, like move through food through the digestive tract or food out of the stomach. Okay, so those are the three kinds of muscle. Skeletal, attached to bones, cardiac, which makes your heart, and smooth muscle, which makes up the walls of hollow organs inside your body. Different kinds of purposes for those three. Then here is the last kind of tissue, nervous tissue. Nervous tissue has two kinds of cells in it. There are cells that transmit electrical information. Those are neurons right here. And then there are cells that don't transmit electrical information. Those are what we call neuroglia, or support cells. And I can see the nucleus of a neuron right here. The major part of this cell is called the cell body, right? Like the major part of you is your body as opposed to your appendages. Inside the cell body is the nucleus, and then here is a long projection going a long distance. It could be a meter within somebody's body. This is an axon. And what I don't see are some small projections coming off the other end of the cell, but if we look at the illustration over here, I can see everything that we want to talk about. So here is the cell body. Another name for cell body is the soma. Soma means body, right? So a somatic sensation is what? A sensation you have on your body someplace. These small projections are dendrites. These are the receiving ends of the cell. These act like little TV antennas that can receive a signal. So probably not many of us have a TV antenna anymore. Maybe you have a dish, right? A satellite dish, which kind of acts like an antenna, but I don't know, does anybody have an antenna anymore? on their TV in here? A couple people? All right. Depending on which way you're facing, if you can point your antenna to Mount Wilson up by Pasadena, then you can have a really good signal, right? Oh, you know what? I think they all transmit digital signals these days anyway, no matter what kind of antenna you have on your TV. This long projection right here is what we call an axon. And the cell body that we see right here will be on the order of microns, 1/1,000,000th of a meter. But this axon right here could be, what, even a meter long. So a million times longer in distance compared to the cell body. So it's a really long part of the cell. And then here's the tip of an axon that is going to be sending information from this cell to a neighboring cell. So dendrites are the receiving end. The axon is the sending part of a neuron. All right, these other cells in here are support cells. They don't send electrical information. They don't receive electrical information. They just help the neuron do its job. As a matter of fact, sometimes they tell neurons how they should connect up with other neurons. So these neuroglia cells or support cells determine what the network inside your body is going to be like. Right, so maybe you have a network of computers at home. It tells how all of these other neurons or computers hook up to each other. Because even a single neuron can make a decision for you. So they're pretty important cells. So don't forget, nervous tissue is made up of neurons and support cells. We'll have to look in some more detail of these cells when we get to the nervous system. But that's good for now. All right, membranes. You have basically two kinds of membranes inside your body. You have, anybody, I think we've talked about this before. Okay. But anybody remember the two kinds of membranes that you have? Let's see if I can find a really dark marker right here. One and two. One and two. Okay, there's one kind of membrane that lines a cavity that's open to the outside world, like your nasal cavity, oral cavity, reproductive tract, digestive tract. Right, mucus, right, O-U-S, that's a mucus membrane. So this is just a quick review because we've talked about this before. Sometimes they secrete mucus, the substance that comes out of a goblet cell, right, what do we call that? M-U-C-U-S, that's the noun form. Mucus is the adjective that's used to modify membrane right here, but mucus is that slippery glycoprotein or sugar protein that's made. What kind of organelle in your body is used for modifying proteins and packaging them? Golgi, yeah, so Golgi makes mucus, right? Golgi body. When it takes a protein from, it gets that from another organelle. What organelle can make a protein? Ribosome, and sometimes endoplasmic reticulum has a ribosome on it. What kind of ER is that? That's rough ER makes a protein, then that protein ends up in the Golgi where it's modified and then packaged in a vesicle for secretion. Okay, and don't forget the name of the cell that does that. That's the goblet cell that you find in an epithelium. It's kind of a modified columnar cell. All right, a second kind of membrane is a serous. Would you use S-E-R-U-S or O-U-S? O-U-S, because it's an adjective, right? Serous membrane. A serous membrane lines a cavity that's not open to the outside world. Could you name a cavity that it's a good thing it's not open to the outside world? Thoracic cavity, that's right. The cavity that your heart is in, the pericardial cavity, the abdominal cavity, and the pelvic cavity are not open to the outside world. So those are good examples of a serous membrane. On the slide that we have right here, here is a membrane that lines the oral cavity. Is that a mucus or a serous membrane? That's a mucus membrane. Now here is a cavity that is lining the pleural cavity. We see it's not open to the outside world, so we call that a serous membrane. Right, serous membrane has got three parts to it. Okay, so A, B, and C. The part, let's start with the deep part. The deep part that is right on the surface of the lung, I see right here. You see that right there? It's right on the surface of the lung. It's touching that visceral organ. The lung is a visceral organ. So I'm going to put that down here in C. That is what we call the visceral serous membrane. Visceral serous membrane. And what do we call the membrane around the lungs, or the cavity that the lungs are in particular? not the thoracic or ventral cavity, but the pleural cavity, right? So you could call that the pleural visceral membrane, right? Because it's touching the lungs itself. All right, then we got a space that's filled with serous fluid. And serous fluid is kind of sticky. It helps glue the lungs to the thoracic wall over here. But before you get to the thoracic wall, you have another part of that serous membrane, right? And that is what we call the parietal division, right? Parietal pleura. Or the parietal serous membrane, to be more general, if it was around some other kind of organ, like abdominal organs or cardiac heart tissue. And then what do you have in between? Serous fluid. Serous fluid has a number of different kinds of properties. If you have a scale, right, and you weigh yourself, and then you throw the scale in a pool, and you jump in the pool and weigh yourself inside the pool, are you going to have the same weight? No, because the water is going to help support you, right? Same thing for serous fluid. It helps float these organs so that they're not quite so heavy, right? So serous fluid does support organs, like the heart has serous fluid, the brain has fluid around it that helps support the brain. All right, so that's one of the functions for serous fluid, is support. Let me move this up over here. Other kinds of serous membranes, you have the peritoneal serous membrane over here with serous fluid. So here is the visceral peritoneum that's surrounding the organ, and then here is the parietal division that's lining the wall of the peritoneal cavity. All right, here is, let me zoom in over here. Here is the heart. So here's the pericardial cavity. The membrane that's right on the surface of the heart is the visceral pericardium. Here is the parietal pericardium, and then you have serous fluid in between as well. If you get an inflammation of this space, that's called pericarditis. Inflammation of the pleural membranes would be called pleurisy. So all those are pretty dangerous. Probably inflammation around the heart would even be worse than pleurisy, because as the pericardial membranes get inflamed, the space gets bigger, right? You have more serous fluid in the pericardial space. So guess what happens if this space gets bigger and bigger and bigger? What happens to the size of the heart? It's got to shrink down, right? And remember, what's the job of the heart? It's got to fill with blood, and when it contracts, it pumps that blood out. But as the heart starts to shrink, because serous fluid builds up on the outside of the heart, it can't expand and can't fill up with blood. And maybe it's contracting just fine, but if there's no blood inside the heart when it contracts, how much blood can it pump? Not very much. That's not a good thing, right? So that's a pretty serious condition. And what would be a really fast way of getting rid of that fluid? Just jab a needle in there, suck it out. Just aspirate it right out of there. And beforehand, the patient won't thank you, but afterwards, they will. Okay. Probably easier said than done. So those are the membranes, two general kinds of membranes. Other than that, you have other membranes in the body, like the cutaneous membrane is the skin, which is what we're going to talk about next. All right, you have a synovial membrane that lines joints, and it secretes a fluid almost like serous fluid right here that lubricates joints. Okay, and there's a few other kinds of membranes. What about your notes? What other membranes do you have that don't fit into this nice, neat category of mucus or serous membrane? In your class notes, do you have any in there? I didn't open it up. I think you've got a couple. You probably got like five or six different kinds of membranes that don't fit nicely into a mucus or serous classification. Cutaneous, synovial. Who is that? Oh, periosteum. Yeah, the periosteum around a bone. Hey, what does osteo mean? Bone. Peri means surrounding. That's a membrane on the outside of a bone. Endosteum is a membrane that lines every cavity on the inside of a bone. Okay, so you run into different kinds of membranes. All right, so that's it for tissues. We just kind of throw membranes in there, although membranes really aren't a tissue. They're made up of a couple different kinds of tissues, but it's a good time to talk about them. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. All right, so let's talk about the cutaneous membrane. Right now, which helps make up the integumentary system, right? So cutaneous membrane or skin. But the integumentary system is something else. It has some other compositions to it besides just skin. It has accessory structures like hair, which you all can see, nails that you can see, right? Glands, and there's some muscle in skin as well. Not very much muscle, but a little bit, and it's a smooth muscle. So if it's a smooth muscle, do you have control as to when it contracts? Nope, it will make up its own mind with the influence of your nervous system when to contract and when it's relaxed. All right? It contracts mostly when you're cold or when you are experiencing a lot of emotional content in your life, for instance. Okay, glands, like sweat glands in your skin. All right, so these are the structures that make the integumentary system. That is also the largest organ system in your body compared to any other system, nervous system or whatever. All right, so let's talk about function. The skin protects internal structure from infections like bacteria and fungi, viral infections, things like that. And also, just as important, maybe even more important, it prevents you from dehydration. Without your skin, any skin on your body, you would probably dehydrate in just about a minute or two. And that would be about it. You'd turn into a potato chip really, really fast. And that's not compatible with life. Another function is regulates body temperature. Because for sure, you know, what happens when you're hot? You sweat, right? And that evaporation of water from your skin cools you down. There's a certain amount of energy that's lost when water evaporates. That cools your body down. Very efficient mechanism for people. And also, your skin is important for producing an active form of vitamin D. You need vitamin D precursors in your diet, but when these precursors get into your skin and you're in sunlight, they convert it into another precursor that can become activated. And vitamin D is necessary for proper absorption of calcium from your diet. So where do you need calcium, if you were to pick? Your bones. Yeah. You think that's important? Everybody said, yeah. Well, okay, I'm going to change your opinion on that as we move through the class. That's probably one of the least important places where you need calcium. But nonetheless, I'm still glad everybody has good calcium in their bones here. Okay, so we'll take a look at that later on. And then sensation. What kind of sensations do you recall? How about sunburn, unfortunately. Sure, when you're out in the sun too much, right? You need a little bit of sun to make vitamin D, but you get too much, right? You can burn your skin very easily, especially in the summertime. What about if you stick your hand in an ice bath? Oh, yeah, temperature. Okay, vibration, pressure, and also pain. So, for instance, if you're that unlucky person that had pericardial effusion, that pericardial space gets really enlarged, right, and we need to aspirate that fluid out, somebody comes at you with a big hypodermic needle, well, you will feel that hypodermic needle unless the skin is anesthetized. All right, so pain. All right, so parts of the skin. You have three main layers. Let's see, chapter 5. I'll get a picture going here. All right, so here's a picture of the skin, and you can see some hair. What kind of structure is hair in the integumentary? Accessory structure. Here are some glands right here, accessory structure. Here's another gland, all right? And then here are some sensory fibers. All right, so we were talking about what? Sensation, right? Okay. Well, what was the next topic? The layers. Very good. Layers of the skin. Let's look at the picture. Going back to layers of the skin. Where is it? Here? Yes. Okay, three main layers. Here is the first layer that we're going to talk about. I'm circling it right here. That is the epidermis. Now, the epidermis has some layers that make it up that we'll look at in just a little bit, but first let's just go with the standard layers. Here's the epidermis. There's a layer underneath it. This is called the dermis. And so if this is the dermis and this is epidermis, what does epidermis mean? Epi means on top of, right? And you could kind of maybe think maybe superior to. If you want to say superior, that's fine with me, okay? And then the third layer is hypodermis down over here. Hypo means what? Below. Like a hypodermic needle introduces material below the dermis, right, into the hypodermis. Okay, so that's why we name it as below the dermis. Now the hypodermis right here is not really part of the integumentary system. It's not part of skin, but it's right there with skin, so we talk about it a little bit in anatomy right at this point in time. It's connective tissue, so it helps connect your skin to underlying structures like muscle and bone and different parts of your body. And you can see it's composed mostly of, well, in, I guess most people, mostly of, what are these cells right here? These are adipocytes, right? So it's adipose connective tissue. And a tremendous amount of adipose can be stored in the hypodermis. All right, so getting back to layers, you got epidermis, then dermis, and hypodermis. Don't forget, hypodermis, not part of the integumentary system. And when you look at the epidermis right here, here is the basement membrane. And you can see it kind of wandering around up and down, up and down. These little ridges right here are what we call papillae. And they're in the dermis, and so we call those dermal papillae. Now, what can you tell me? What's one kind of really startling or funny characteristic of an epidermis? Or an epithelium in general? These cells are close together, and indeed they're so close together. Do you see any blood vessels here because those cells are so close together? No blood vessels. But nonetheless, if there's living cells, they need oxygen and nutrients, and they get it from blood vessels that poke up into the dermal papillae via the subpapillary vascular plexus. So cells that are close to these capillaries, namely cells down here by the basal region, are alive, but the cells that are really far away up by the apical surface right here are dead a long time ago. Right? And don't forget, so cells move from the basal layer up to the apical layer. These are just falling off your body all the time. They're rubbing off clothes, rub them off, but they're replaced by other cells down below them. So on this slide, you probably can get an impression that there are layers within the epidermis, and indeed there are. You have a couple different kinds of skin. You have some skin that has hair on it, like I see right here, and other kinds of skin that doesn't have hair. What part of your body doesn't have hair? Like the palms of your hands, soles of your feet. I've never seen anybody with hair there, but there probably is somebody. Anybody ever? Brother, sister with hair on the palms of your hand? Brothers with hair? No? Okay. I've never seen it. So, there just aren't hair follicles in that part of the body. So it's not that it just rubs off, which would be my first guess, okay, but there just aren't hair follicles there. So skin that's on the palms of your hand, soles of your feet, we call that thick skin. It's modified to resist more abrasion than skin in other parts of the body. And then skin everywhere else that has hair follicles on it. Some parts of your body doesn't look like it has hair, but it's thin skin that has rubbed off. The hair has rubbed off, so you don't see hair follicles. Like your forehead has hair follicles. You don't really see it. I don't know. They're just not very prominent. I don't think it rubs off, but they're just not very prominent in that region. Okay, so thin skin. Let's look at some layers of thin skin first. Okay, here are some layers. This is a pretty good illustration. The illustration from the previous edition of the book I like a lot more than this one, so I think I included that in the exam study guide, but the labeling of these cells is pretty much the same, or maybe I switched it out to this one. I don't know. When you get to your exam study guide for integumentary system, let's just see. Is it, I can't tell. Is it this one? No, it's the old one. I like the old one better. Because the old one, you can see cells in metaphase. Ooh, what does that mean? What are they doing? Mitosis. It means they're growing, right? They're replacing these cells that are being lost up over here. So the previous edition is maybe a little bit better. You can see some cells undergoing mitosis. All right, this layer, here's a dermal papillae, so we zoomed right into this region up over here, so we zoomed in quite a lot. This is what we call the stratum basale. So all these different layers are going to be called stratum, right? So this is what, a stratified squamous epithelium, the epidermis, stratified squamous epithelium. All right, but this basal layer, the cells could be a little columnar or cuboidal, or pillow-shaped, but it doesn't matter. All the cells up here by the apical surface are squamous. These cells are undergoing mitosis, and so we call this the stratum basale. That's the name of this layer right here. This is the growth layer, and that's why these cells are here. Some other cells that we see in this region is this dark cell right here. This is what we call a melanocyte. So we're going to get to know the names of some other cells. You know a lot of names of cells already, like the name of a cell in bone is called an osteocyte. The name of a cell in cartilage is called a chondrocyte, and the name of a cell that carries oxygen in blood is called a erythrocyte, or you could call it red blood cell. But this cell right here is a melanocyte. You also have to know the name of the compound that it's secreting. It is producing, it's not really secreting, but it's producing a compound called melanin. And melanin is a pigment. And a pigment is just a chemical compound that can absorb light. So, for instance, in the chairs there is a pigment, all right? And it's a pigment because you see these chairs have a certain color to them. What color do you see? I see yellow, all right? The pigment that's in these chairs absorbs all different colored light except yellow. So it's absorbing blue, it's absorbing red, but what's it doing to the yellow wavelength, or the yellow color in light? It's hitting the chair, bouncing off and into your eyes, and so what do you see? The color yellow, right? So there's different color pigments depending on what energies of light or colors of light they absorb. And this melanin right here looks brown to black in color. So it absorbs what? Almost all colors that come from the sun. So it acts as protection. It protects you from sunlight. Melanin is a pigment that protects you from sunlight. And what's the name of the cell that produces melanin? It's a melanocyte. And these are sort of interesting cells. They come from your nervous system. They crawl around in your body. They find this layer of the skin, and then they're happy and they start to live here for long periods of time. But every once in a while, they turn cancerous. And what's the basic nature of this cell? What does it like to do? It likes to move around, crawl around in different spots of your body. And when it becomes cancerous, then it can take that cancerous form and go to other parts of your body. We call that metastasis. That's why a melanoma is so dangerous, because it likes to move from your skin to your brain, to your bones, to your liver, right? It's kind of a really hard form of cancer to treat, but some people are getting pretty good at it. I think if you get sunburn on your skin, it's due to damage of neurons that are in your skin, or receptors, pressure receptors, like this tactile cell right here. Those are actually damaged, and when they're damaged, they like to leak ions, and that's an electrical current when an ion is in motion, and so that produces an inappropriate sensation, like a burn or a tingling kind of sensation. Okay, so you'll find melanocytes. After the cells divide, they move up to the next layer right here. That's a stratum spinosum. This is where the cells start to develop tight junctions between them. They start to get glued together. They change their shape a little bit. They begin to have a spiky appearance to them. And so that's called the stratum spinosum. In the stratum spinosum, here's another kind of cell. And this is an immune cell. It fights infection because we don't want bacteria coming through here. Right? This is called a dendritic cell, or sometimes it's called a Langerhans cell. Maybe I have to spell that, Langerhans. Let's see if I can spell it. L-A-N-G-E-R. That's probably in your notes. Anyway, Langerhans. And dendritic cell, exactly the same kind of cell. Right? So don't forget, a particular item can have more than one name. Okay? Like, for instance, what did I use in the past? Some people call me Honey, but what do you call me? Dr. Golber, right? So you just have to know the appropriate circumstances. Okay. All right, so stratum spinosum is a next superficial layer. Then as these cells migrate, okay, then they have to change their internal structure so that they can start to perform the function of skin. Okay, what did we say the function of skin was? Protection, right? Protects you from invasion of microorganisms, but also dehydration. And oils or lipids are an important barrier to water. And so granules develop that make an oil, the compound that eventually gets secreted, that then protects you from dehydration. But these granules also contain a compound that makes the cells really tough. And that chemical compound is called keratin. And we can find it in these granules. So this layer looks very granular, so we call it the stratum granulosum. All right? And then these cells move up into the last layer right here, and those glycolipids are secreted outside the cell. That's a vapor barrier or water barrier so you don't dry out. And these cells are filled with that compound that make them really hard. That compound is called keratin. So your skin is kind of tough compared to other kinds of cells that you have in your body. And other parts of your skin are even tougher than the rest of your skin. What are some accessory structures that are even tougher than your skin? Like your nails, right? They're just an epidermal cell that are completely filled with that chemical that we call keratin. Okay, and hair as well is a lot tougher than the rest of your skin. And those are just epidermal cells that grow in columns instead of sheets. They're filled with a chemical compound called keratin. Now, hair can have different colors. Hair can be brown or black because they incorporate different amounts of what? Melanin from melanocytes within a hair follicle. Okay, and the lighter your hair is, the less melanin you have. All right, so these are all called keratinocytes because their job is to make keratin that is intracellular. Now, how's that different than collagen? Let's make a distinction between collagen and keratin. Keratin, we said, is where? Inside the cells. Where do you find collagen? Outside the cells. And do you find collagen in an epithelium? Where do you find collagen? In a connective tissue. And it's in what part of the connective tissue? You could say the extracellular material, and you'd be right, but remember, it's got a special term. It's called the matrix. Collagen is in the matrix. Keratin, which is sounds similar but spelled totally differently, is intracellular inside these cells right here. All right, so these are the layers of the epidermis, starting with the superficial layer, stratum corneum, stratum granulosum, stratum spinosum, and then stratum basale right here. And then you got to throw in a few other cells besides keratinocytes, like the Langerhans cell and the melanocyte right here. Okay, and this little Merkel's disc, that's for sensation. Light touch, light vibration. All right, but we said you're made of more than one kind of skin. What's another kind of skin are you made up of? Thick skin. And thick skin is kind of similar, all right, but it's a little bit different because it's missing hair, and it has one additional layer associated with it. So here is not just a nice illustration, but here is a micrograph. I don't know if this is an exam figure or not. It might be, but the previous figure certainly is the illustration because it's so easy to see. All right, so what is at the bottom or the base of every epithelial layer? A basement membrane, right? So here's the basement membrane right here. All right, this is not just the typical epithelium, but this is the epidermis in particular. And what kind of epithelium is the epidermis? Go ahead, classify this beast for me. It is stratified. That's really easy to see. And these cells are flat up over here, so it's a stratified squamous epithelium. And I can see a number of different layers. And we talked about the importance of some of those layers already. So here's the stratum basale. You might see some brown cells in here. Those are the melanocytes. Right? And if you're the person that has a lot of melanocytes, what color is your skin going to be?
Dark.
Really dark. And what's the good thing about that? That's natural sunscreen, right? It protects you from when you go outside, when you go out in the sun. It keeps your skin from burning, but also it helps protect your skin and all these cells down below it from mutating, right? So it helps prevent cancer as well. All right, so the more melanocytes you have, more melanin you have, the more skin protection you have from the stratum basale. Then we have the stratum spinosum. I can see some cells that have granules in them. That's the stratum granulosum. And of course, the stratum corneum is very thick, right? It's a very deep layer, very thick layer in thick skin, like what I would expect to see. But here is the additional layer. It's a really thin layer, and it just looks like a separation, but it's not. There's cells in here, and they're very clear cells. And when you're speaking clearly, what does somebody say to you? You're speaking lucidly, right? So lucid means clear. So here's the stratum lucidum. And so if you were to see this slide, you'd say, ah, this is thick skin because I see the stratum lucidum in here as well. All right, so what are the layers? Let's do it from deep this time to superficial. You got stratum basale, stratum spinosum, stratum granulosum, stratum lucidum, and then stratum corneum. All right, so in anatomy, I didn't tell you this, in anatomy we're really interested in layers. And in medicine we're really interested in layers because sometimes these cells misbehave, like maybe that melanocyte turns carcinogenic and wants to break away from skin and move around. You're going to see it break through the basement membrane or maybe up to the surface of the skin right here. All right, so we got to know what layers that melanoma is in to stage that particular cancer. So we got to know layers of the skin, because if we stage that cancer, we know how to treat it, right? And if we know how to treat it, we know what your prognosis is. You're going to live, how long you might live, right? Or if you have no chance. So early detection, of course, is very important. So knowing the layers is really important in understanding pathology of the integumentary system. All right, so let's not forget our layers at all. We'll look at lots of layers in a lot of different tissues. All right, so all of this is epidermis with all these layers right here. What do we have below the epidermis or deep to the epidermis? We've got the dermis. All right, so here is the dermis, and the dermis has two main layers. All right, next to these dermal papillae, we call this the papillary layer. And the papillary layer, papillary layer right here, maybe in your notes, write down that is loose areolar CT. Okay, and how strong is areolar CT? Not very strong in the scheme of things. It's got some collagen, just not a lot. All right, but what do we see down here in the deep layer of the dermis? A lot of collagen fibers. And so this layer down here is dense irregular CT. It has a lot of collagen. It can withstand a lot more force and tension. And since it's irregular, your skin resists stretching in all kinds of different dimensions, and it has elastic tissue too. So if you do stretch skin a little bit, it can go back to its original location as long as you don't overstretch it. Like, when might that happen? Like when you're pregnant, okay? And some of these abdominal pelvic cavity gets really enlarged, that overstretches the skin. It damages these collagen fibers and elastic fibers, right? And you have these little micro scars in your skin. Those are called striae, okay? Or birthmarks, because these fibers get overstretched. Don't know a way of preventing that. That's just a natural process, right, when you're pregnant. All right, so do you see all these collagen fibers down over here? All right, so for skin, you got to know the three main layers. Well, one is not really a layer. The two main layers of skin are the epidermis and dermis. Down below it is the hypodermis. That doesn't really count. And then all the sublayers, right? The sublayers, stratum corneum, stratum lucidum, granulosum, spinosum basale, and then the papillary layer and the reticular layer within the dermis. All right, so I don't know, does anybody have any leather shoes or fancy leather pants or leather jacket? Probably a couple people still, not wearing just purely synthetic clothes. Where does that leather come from? And what's in there? What's the chemical compound that gives leather its strength? Where does leather come from? From the hides of animals, all right? So from the integumentary system of animals. But what layer? Okay. Could it be the epidermis? Ah, here's living cells. What happens when you kill a living cell? Well, it gets really messy and stinky, right? You wouldn't want to wear that. So when somebody makes leather, those are digested away or rubbed off the hide. And then you're left with the dermis, and in particular, just the reticular layer here, because that's the layer that has most of the collagen, which is the strongest material, right? So shoes are made out of this layer of the integumentary system. This also kind of underscores why, when the skin is lacerated, when you cut all the way through the skin, what can you do to help healing of the skin? Because it's filled with collagen, at least that reticular layer of the dermis, you can suture it back together because that collagen is nice and strong. It will hold that suture that's placed really nicely until things start to grow back. All right, so those are the layers. Okay, resist abrasion. So don't forget, cells grow from the stratum basale up to the stratum corneum. All right, so those are cornified cells, which means what? They're dead and filled with keratin. That's what cornified means. And the shape of these cells, they transit from being columnar to more squamous as they move up to the apical layer. Okay, so what do you want to know? For sure, keratinocytes. These are filled with keratin. You got melanocytes in there, Merkel cells, that's a touch receptor. All right, there's that Langerhans cell, that's a macrophage that helps fight infections. All right, the granulosum has these granules that are going to eventually secrete that waterproofing material. It's a glycolipid, and glycolipid, right, is part sugar. That's the glyco, the glyc part of this word. And then if we put lipid on it, just put an O between them when we combine these two chemicals together. Lipid is what? Lipid, does it like to mix with water? No, that's the permeability barrier right there. Okay. Okay. So I think we talked about all this pretty much. The dermis. Strength comes from collagen. Is that collagen intracellular or extracellular? Extracellular. What about keratin? It's intracellular. All right, the layer, the papillary layer versus reticular layer. I want to go back and talk about that one diagram a little bit, but let's talk before we do skin color just a little bit. Okay, pigments. Remember, a pigment is a chemical, and it can absorb light, and not all pigments are the same. Like in the chair is a yellow pigment. You have, what kind of pigments in here? You got blue pigments, right? Yeah, thank you. Somebody's trying to trick me. All right, so what kind of pigments are in here? What colors make blue? It's what, green and yellow make blue, if I'm right? So the pigments in here don't absorb green and yellow. They reflect both green and yellow back to your eye, and your eye mixes them together and makes it look blue. But what wavelengths does get absorbed by this blue pigment? Red. Okay, everything else, orange, get absorbed, but it just reflects yellow and green. Oh no, yellow and blue make green. Okay, forget it. So anyway, you know, color's not my forte. Okay. All right, so you have blood in your skin. What color does blood make your skin look? Yeah, red, or maybe a washed out red, which is pink. Right, so where you don't have a lot of other natural pigments, like in your lips, okay, your lips kind of look red. Or if you have an area in your body where you have a big flushing of blood, then it's going to look red, as long as it's not blocked out by other melanocytes that you have right there. Moles and age spots are an increased number of melanocytes. So if you're typically kind of light-colored skin, you might have darky splotches every once in a while. That's because you just have a bunch of melanocytes in that area that are hanging out that make that area look a little bit darker. All right, freckles are an increased production of melanin, maybe the same numbers of melanocytes, but in that area they're just a little bit hyperactive. They secrete a little bit more melanin into that area. And then here is a condition, an abnormal condition called albinism. All right, and I don't know if I'd really call that a pathological condition, but it is abnormal because if we look around the room, all right, I see pretty much normal pigmentation everywhere in the room. Albinism is an individual that cannot produce any kind of melanin whatsoever. All right, so they're going to look just like their parents, just like all of their ethnic background dictates that they should be, right, depending on your origin. But what? Completely devoid of color. So your hair is going to be completely white. Your skin is completely white, but your lips are still what? Pink, because there's still blood going through them. All right? And what can you tell me about a person with albinism? Very sensitive to sunlight, right? You can go out into the sun in LA, and in 30 seconds, your skin will start to burn, right? So it's really dangerous. So in Southern California, do we see many people with albinism? No, and it's probably not right to call them albinos. They're really people with this particular process, right? But where would you expect to see people with albinism? Way far north, like Seattle. Right, that has not much sunlight, even hardly any during the wintertime. It's cloudy all the time. They can go outdoors without getting burned up. So that would be a really fantastic place to live if you have albinism. All right, so that's inherited and congenital. That means that you get the traits from both of your parents, and congenital means that you're born with it. It's not something that develops during your lifetime. But some people do get white spots on their skin that develop over their lifetime. That's a developmental condition, and it might be inherited, right? But it's not congenital. It's what we call what? Developmental. And anybody know the name of that particular condition? Oh, yeah, it came back to me. Like vitiligo would be one of them, okay? And I know one of my nephews has really, really dark skin because he's part Guamanian, part Panamanian, part, you know, all other kinds of different kinds of things. And on his forehead, he has that condition, so he's really susceptible because when he goes outside, he's usually really robust to sunlight because he's really dark colored, except for what? That one spot on his forehead has a tendency to burn. So that's the spot, that just one spot in his body that he has to put sunblock on to protect it. Or wear a hat. Okay. Cyanosis is a different kind of color. It's a blue kind of color. When you have blood that's oxygenated, it looks red. Red blood cells look red when they're carrying oxygen. And when they give up oxygen to tissues, then venous blood looks kind of bluish. It still has a little bit of red color to it, but it looks kind of blue. But if blood is not returning to the lungs properly or being pumped by the heart properly to get back to the lungs to pick up oxygen, then blood even in arteries is not so red colored. It's kind of what colored? It's kind of blue, right? And so somebody will have a cyanotic condition or cyanosis when their blood isn't going through the lungs or their heart properly. And this is a condition that happens frequently in newborns, if they have cardiovascular disease, if their heart isn't formed properly, or if their pulmonary function is decreased, right? That's one of the first things that looks that is looked at immediately. As soon as you were born, guess what somebody looked at? Not how many fingers and toes you had, but the color, right? Because that determines how well your heart is functioning, and that could be a much more, well, that's definitely a much more serious condition than how many fingers and toes you have, right? Okay, so cyanosis. Another condition that you could be born with, and again, when you're first born, they're not only looking to see if you're blue or cyanotic, but if you're jaundiced. What color is that? That's a yellow color. And that just means that for some reason, right, red blood cells are dying very rapidly in your body, and the products, namely hemoglobin inside those red blood cells, isn't being processed as fast as it could be. Maybe because too many red blood cells are dying and your liver can't process all the red blood cells are dying, or maybe just the right number is dying but there's something wrong with the liver. Could be either one of those two conditions. And a compound called bilirubin is building up, and that is a yellow pigment. All right, so even if you have a lot of melanin in your body, your skin is really dark, some parts of your body still will be yellow, like your fingernails, and the whites of your eyes will still be yellow. So even adults can become jaundiced. For instance, if you have a cancer that metastasizes to the liver, or if maybe you're taking chemotherapy, which knocks down the function of the liver, you can become jaundiced as a result of that. So that's a yellow condition, but not a really bright kind of yellow. Okay, birthmarks. You might have kind of a dark area in your body that's not due to a mole or freckles. It might be kind of reddish, which means what? You have a certain plexus of a blood vessel that's very close to the skin that shows up as a dark spot. And all of these things, of course, can change with age. Okay, so those are some interesting things about skin color. Accessory structures of the skin. A hair. Okay. The shaft lies above the surface of the skin. The root and bulb are below the surface. And the hair follicle is something that we find below the surface of the skin. So let's go take a look at a picture of this kind of thing. Oh, here. Let me find it over here. Hair. You know what? Let's look at this. Let's go back to this picture. Right here. All right, so here is the hair follicle. Here's the shaft, right, because it's above the surface of the skin. Here is the hair follicle. Here is the bulb. And the root down here, and you can see there's a papillae with a vascular plexus on the inside that's nourishing this hair right here so that it can continue to grow. And let's just reiterate why we should have an interest in layers of, well, everything, but in particular the skin. Well, we said in terms of staging pathology, but also for maybe understanding something about burns. All right, so let's just say this individual right here, and here's nice healthy skin, burned this part of the skin. All right, and let's just say the skin burned, and all these hair shafts are burned off, and it was burned down to, actually none of these cells were burned right here, but enough heat to cause a vasodilation in these blood vessels. So Some of these cells are partly damaged, but these blood vessels now are enlarged. They have a lot of blood going to this part of the skin that was damaged. What does the skin look like with a lot of extra blood flowing to it? It's going to look red, right? That's what we call a first-degree burn. Not too damaging. Maybe these hair shafts are burned off, but still the stratum basale right here is still nice and alive. So what's the prognosis for somebody with a first-degree burn? Really, really good, right? Because these cells that are undergoing mitosis, they're going to continue to undergo mitosis and replace any cells that maybe got damaged in some of these more superficial layers right here. So is that person lucky or unlucky? Really lucky. And that's typically what sunburn can produce. But don't forget there can be other genetic changes that happen, right, that can in later years produce skin cancer due to sunlight. All right. Second degree burn. Maybe the stratum corneum, okay, is really damaged as well as some of the deeper layers. And now there's some real damage to these blood vessels right here in that form this subdermal plexus, papillary plexus right here. So they start to leak a lot of fluid because now they're damaged. And what does that leaky fluid produce? It produces a blister underneath the epidermis right here. So that's a little bit more damaging circumstance. But as long as you're careful, is that person lucky? Yeah, because that blister, right, you don't rip it off the skin. As long as the skin is still remain intact, you have that blister, hurts really bad, but still what? It's a permeability barrier, and bacteria can't get in. So the skin is still performing its function. All right, let's think of two more cases. Another case, when somebody burns their skin, and the skin is lost, maybe even charred off, to this level, let's say, right through here. Okay, all the way down. So the epidermis in this whole region is gone. Is that person lucky or unlucky? Okay, I want to change your opinion because I know something about these layers. That's still a lucky person for the following reason. All right, in the region where the skin is completely missing, like right here, indeed, infection can still happen very fast. They'll dehydrate very rapidly, but with proper protection, they can live through this very nicely because look at this layer right here. What layer am I tracing? I'm in the epidermis, but what layer exactly? Yeah, the stratum basale. What's taking place in the stratum basale? Mitosis. Those cells can replace. Now, where does the stratum basale go when it gets to a hair follicle? Look where it goes. All the way down to the very bottom of this hair follicle right here, so that if somebody burns this part of their skin, what about the part of the stratum basale right here? It's still growing. It can still repopulate as long as the person survives, right? The skin in that area of the body, right? So just by knowing that you have this living layer down here, then you protect this layer because this part of the skin is going to grow back for that individual. That's really, really nice, right? So that's why I think this person is lucky, because of that stratum basale going everywhere. Now, what about somebody that has a burn that goes all the way down to the hypodermis? Can their skin grow back? Never, ever, ever, under any circumstance. So then what do they need? They need a skin graft from some other part of their body or temporarily from another animal to protect them from dehydration and infection. And that would be a really unlucky, unfortunate person. Okay, so that's why it's really important to know layers and how we understand and treat disease processes. Okay, some other things, other accessory structures that we see in skin. This right here is a gland. And it secretes water and salty type fluid to the surface of the skin for evaporation when you're hot. This is an eccrine sweat gland. Okay, in lab you're going to see another kind of sweat gland, which is maybe about 10 times the size of this one, but it still has the same kind of form. It's called an apocrine gland. And it has a duct. Oh, what kind of gland has a duct? As opposed to a gland that has no ducts. A gland that has ducts is called exocrine. What about a gland that has no ducts? Endocrine gland, yeah. So here is an exocrine gland in particular, an eccrine exocrine gland, takes sweat up to the surface via this duct. All right, the other one, which is much bigger, is an apocrine gland. It doesn't secrete sweat, it secretes an organic material, and that organic material can inhibit the growth of harmful bacteria. Okay, and it can secrete lubricating materials onto the surface of the skin, all right? But because it's an organic material, bacteria can live in it, Some bacteria, at least the helpful bacteria, can, and it produces an odor. Right, so certain parts of our body are a little bit more odoriferous than others, not because the secretion is odoriferous, but because that material is broken down. For instance, in the axillary region, where's your axilla? This is just a practice of anatomy. That's your armpit, right? An inguinal region, okay? I suppose you could say that's your crotch, but inguinal region is a proper term, right? Okay, because it has what kind of glands? Apocrine glands. All right, a third kind of gland that we see right here, this is a sebaceous gland. It secretes sebum, and that's more of an oily material. And so it helps lubricate this hair shaft, so as it grows out from the hair follicle, it doesn't get trapped. And again, it's an exocrine gland, and it secretes a compound we call sebum, secreted by a sebaceous gland. Some other accessory structures. Here's a little muscle. And it's not under your voluntary control. What kind of muscle could it be if it's involuntarily controlled? Smooth muscle. What else could it be?
Cardiac,
but this is not your heart, right? So it can't be cardiac muscle, so it's got to be smooth muscle, and indeed it is. Part of one end of the muscle is attached to the epidermis right at the basement membrane right here, and the other part is attached to the basement membrane of a hair follicle. When it contracts, okay, it causes this hair follicle that has maybe a tendency to kind of lie down on an angle to what? Pop up like that. Right? Just a little lever action. It pops up straight. But it also has a tendency, what? To pull the hair follicle up out of the skin. And when it does, of course, it doesn't pop out of your skin. It just forms what? A little dome of skin right here that we call a goose pimple or a goose bump. So that muscle contracts when you're cold or experiencing high emotional states in your life. It contracts and you get goose pimples when that happens. Okay, those are some accessory structures. Other kinds of accessory structures. Here is a specialized sense organ. This is called a Pacinian corpuscle. What does it remind you of? An onion, a big onion, with a number of different layers right here. This is important for deep pressure and vibration, right? So something that can almost damage your skin, it's so strong. That's a Pacinian corpuscle. You have others up closer to the surface of the skin called Meissner's corpuscles. They kind of look like an onion, but they're really little. Right? Those are for light touch and vibration. You have free nerve endings in the skin that maybe go to this hair follicle right here, so that when something brushes up against the hair follicle, these nerve endings deform, and you can feel that something is moving that hair follicle around, whether it's your clothing, for instance, or wind or whatever. All right, there are other free nerve endings that are in tissue, so I'm not sure I see a free nerve ending. Maybe I could, it looks like it's going to a hair follicle. But free nerve endings have two important functions. One is for pain sensation, and the other is for temperature sensation. So there are some free nerve endings that you can feel cold, there are other free nerve endings that you can feel hot. And as a matter of fact, the cold nerve endings, when they get stimulated, I got it backwards once again in my mind. I think the microphone, is my microphone on? Yeah, it's still on. It's the cold nerve endings, right, that you can feel cold, but sometimes they can also be stimulated with excessively hot compounds. So when something's really, really hot and placed on your skin, you feel a burning sensation, but what else do you feel? A cold sensation, because sometimes the cold nerve endings are stimulated by heat as well. Okay, that's just a paradoxical sense that you have. All right, and pain sensation is really good. Why is that? Because it's telling your brain, your consciousness, that some damaging stimulus is being applied to your body. And then what naturally will you do? You will withdraw your body from that painful stimulus or that damaging stimulus, thereby protecting your body. So in that sense, pain sensation is very, very important. All right, so those are important accessory structures. Tell you what, you have some important diagrams. For instance, on the nail, here's a nail. I think this down here is an exam figure. And The nail right here is made up of keratinocytes, right? And it's just flat sheets of epidermal cells that are loaded with keratin, even more than what you find in normal skin. grow from the nail matrix. So here you see that term matrix again, but in this particular case, it's from an epithelium, not a connective tissue, and the nail grows from the nail matrix. Here is the root of the nail. The root of the nail is underneath the cuticle, or sometimes we call that the proximal nail fold. So is this nail growing from the nail root? No, it's growing from the matrix. Where does a plant grow from? The root, right? But don't get that confused because we're not plants. Right? So nails grow from the matrix, not the root. You can damage the root of a nail. As a matter of fact, some people get a fungus that's really resistant to treatment, maybe in their toes, and this whole nail has to be removed, including the root right here, because remember, that's just dead epithelial cells filled with keratin. And will that nail grow back? Yeah, because the nail matrix hasn't been destroyed, right? Just the root has been removed. Okay, and then you have the body of the nail and then the free edge out over here. And oh, here's a little bone right here, and you can see some subcutaneous tissue, some adipose tissue. All right, so I think you should be able to label that. Okay. What else about this particular chapter? Oh, diseases of the skin. Okay. Well, here we see a nice melanoma. That's a really dangerous kind of cancer. And what compound are those melanocytes producing? Melanin, right? Just a nice brown to black pigment right here. So what is the most damaging thing that people do to their skin day in and day out? Just sunlight. Exposing your skin to sunlight is the most damaging thing. So I want to get over here. Okay. And okay, aging. So when it comes to aging skin, since sunlight is the thing that damages skin the most, right, sunlight prematurely ages skin. Unless you're lucky enough to have what? A lot of melanocytes protecting your skin, right? Otherwise, you got to use clothing or artificial sunblock. Oh, I did have a really nice sign-in sheet, but I have it. Oh, you did? Okay, try passing around, but we're almost out of time. As a matter of fact, we are out of time, okay? But if you feel like signing the sign-in sheet, you're welcome to do that. But I got carried away before I sent the sign-in sheet around. Sorry about that. So you do not have to sign a sign-in sheet today. All right, when we begin next time, we're going to talk about aging of the skin. All right, so what's one way to age your skin prematurely? Going out in sunlight, okay? What characteristic of skin means that your skin will stay young for a long period of time? If you have a lot of melanocytes, you're just lucky enough to have skin that's going to last you a long time, and it's not going to age very quickly.